Welcome to the first episode of Send For You. I'm your host, Sachi. This is a podcast series that highlights voices and the stories behind them in San Francisco. Over the years, I've found myself in the midst of people whose stories that are relatable, shocking, emotional, uncomfortable, and riveting all at the same time. They've pushed my reflex to snap judgment. The people I'm going to bring on have lifestyles and careers I only read about on the internet or in books, but I get frustrated because I don't think that they're asked the right questions sometimes. But these are people I actually know, so let me ask the questions and prove their answers are worth your time. I'll let you know more about me as it comes up, but know that I'm a 20-something in grad school in San Francisco, with a love for storytelling and having my perceptions kicked in. I'm a natural skeptic, which I think is just a defense mechanism for actually wanting to be a believer. You're probably wondering what the name of the show Send For You actually means. It comes from what I deem is the greatest moment in television, I know what we're all thinking, the season 4 reunion of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, where Kenya Moore says the most iconic line I've ever heard in my life.
You know, so people need to know on this stage, don't come for me unless I send for you.
Don't come for me unless I send for you. It's obviously violently shady, and I live for it, but you know that this show is not meant to be aggressive. All I'm saying is that, to the people I want to talk to, I'm sending for you. My first guest ever is Neutrina Gandana. She's a program director for a nonprofit called The Last Mile. I want you to hear what she has to say, because her work attacks our common perceptions of prison inmates, their potential upon release, and reducing recidivism rates in a really unique and modern way. We talk about being your own boss, mass incarceration, and our personal friendship of over 6 years. We're actually from the same hometown and went to rival high schools, but met years later. She's a dear friend, and I can't wait for you to hear from the ultimate cool girl in nonprofits. The Neutrina that I met, let's now say 6 years ago, is very different.
I'm glad.
I love the come
up. She was a good time, though.
Still a good time. Still a good time.
I liked the craziness, though, sometimes, you know, like the
I
drama.
Think that's not gone.
Okay.
I think you're like, yes. Yes.
I love the drama. Now I feel right. Like, you know, like, oh, like, I've got a long-term partner. Yeah. I'm, like, happy. I'm living in I have a good job. I have a good place to live. It's, everything's pretty chill. Whereas before, it was like, everything is DEFCON 5, you know, like, everyone's cheap. Like, I love everyone. I hate everyone. It was very much, like, me versus them.
Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Sachi. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. This is, like, somewhat awkward because we are friends.
Yeah.
And this is...
In real life.
Yeah, not even professionally at all.
Like, while we're talking right now, it's very natural. It's not like I feel like I'm being interviewed for a position at your company. It's
my podcast. Yeah. I definitely wanted this to be a conversation. And some of the reason why I wanted you to come on is because I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about what you do. Because I think that we hear about prison reform a lot. It's a really big word. People might think that it's one thing, but you're actually attacking this issue from a very specific angle. And I wanted to kind of unpack that.
Yeah. So as an intro, you know, I am currently the program director for an organization called Last Mile. We teach coding and technology education inside United States prisons. Right now, we're across 5 California locations with hopes to expand to about, you know, 25 different states and countries within the next couple of years. And we are committed to, you know, bringing technology education. We believe that having a job is the key to breaking the cycle of incarceration. And we believe that second chances are important. And, you know, I've been working in the prison system for about 5.5 years now. It's been a long time. It's a big passion of mine. But I think at a bottom line, you go into a prison, you talk to the people, you understand their stories, and you see how similar they are to you. You see how easy you could have been in those situations, how you probably were in those situations and didn't get caught. And if you were shunned away, if you were given that scarlet letter, if you were pushed and marginalized in society, how would you want people to treat you? You know, would you want people to treat you like you are smart, or like you are a criminal, like you are, you know, a destitute? Like, what we're doing with The Last Mile is just providing an opportunity to succeed. Not saying, look, you go through our program, you're going to be the best of the best. No, you go through our program, it's going to be a lot of work. You're going to have to prove a lot of different mindsets wrong. You're going to have to prove a lot to yourself, to your family, to your friends, to society. But given these tools, you can do it. And we believe in you. And I think that's really all people really want to hear, is that someone believes in them. And there are a lot of people in prison who have no one to believe in them. So to give them a space where they are empowered through education is really important to me.
Your journey started at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
You came in and I knew you before you had entered UC Berkeley. And as soon as you got there, you got involved in volunteering in prison, which, you know, I saw that and I was like, whoa, that's really cool. And then you turned it into a career where you came to a nonprofit that had funding from a couple of founders.
Small private grants, donations here and there.
Right. And you took it from literally just you to what it is right now. So, like, how did you navigate that responsibility?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
So, you know, when I was in Berkeley, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to do human rights, which is probably the most vague and, you know, umbrella of doing the right thing you could think of. But I knew that I wanted to do something where I could help people. And when I heard about the opportunity for teaching prison when I was at Berkeley, I remember stopping by in the classroom and just hearing all the statistics about prison and incarceration. I realized I don't know anything about this, you know? I assume that people who are in prison are bad people, you know, that we grow up from the same place. That's, like, mm-hmm. the same thing that we hear constantly. People who go to prison. We don't know a lot of people who go to prison. You know, we are constantly, you know, just not part of that world. And when I'm hearing these statistics, you know, one in every 10 Americans has a criminal background. One in three black men are incarcerated at some point in their life. The average length of solitary confinement is 6.8 years in California. All of these are incredibly
Damn.
Shocking. And they're so shocking to a point where you're like, what's going on here? You know, it piqued my interest a lot. And so when I entered the program and the first time I ever got in and actually volunteered inside a prison, I was blown away by how normal these people were,
mm.
you know, that I had this, like, idea of this, like, other, and that they're, you know, they're bad people or anything, but they're people who are our age, they're people who look like our brothers, our sisters, our fathers, our mothers, all of these, and they are people who are brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. You know, there are people who have made a mistake, there are people who the system is against them, there are people who have never given even a chance. So it really varies, and one moment that really stuck out to me when I was working inside a prison, just tutoring at this time, was a moment when I was working with an individual and he was going through his workbook and he was really confused and, like, you know, I was working with him for maybe like 20 minutes at this time and it was just like marginal math, you know, 2 + 2, whatever, very elementary stuff. And he was going through the book and he was flipping through the pages of Telling How to Tell Time. And he was 70 years old, keep in mind, and he had been told his entire life that he was too dumb, that he was bound to be a failure, that he was not worthy. And I spent an hour of my time working with him, trying to teach him how to tell time, because he had resisted. He had been like, no, like, everyone told me this is too hard for me, like, I'll just do this next time.
To tell time.
Yes. And I was like, no, you need to know this. Like, this is something you need to know. We're going to do it right now. And so I spent an hour of my time with him. And that's not necessarily, like, you're not supposed to spend too much time with a specific student because over familiarity, etc. But it ended up paying off because at the end of it, he started to learn how to tell time. And then after that moment, every single time I came back into the prison, he kept, like, pointing at the clock and being like, oh, it's, like, 11:30, it's 9:30, whatever it is. And he was proud of himself, and I saw that he was happy because he learned this educational skill. And so that really made me feel like, you know, this is a really good feeling. This is what I want to be doing. This is what I believe we should be doing. Everyone, regardless of what you've done, and there are definitely a variety of kinds of people inside a prison, but regardless of what you've done, you've done, what you've committed, you deserve the right to educate yourself. You deserve the right to make yourself better or to give yourself an opportunity to get better. So I did that for a while. You know, I was the director of that program for 2 years, organizing people to go to UC Berkeley. And that's actually where I met The Last Mile. They came in as a speaker to my program. And I talked to Chris Redlitz, who's the founder, and I just kind of fell in love with the program. At the time, they were doing a business entrepreneurship program, something that I've never even really considered. You know, I don't think of private industry as a method to advance social good.
That sounds really douchey.
Exactly, right? I don't think of that, you know? And here it is. Here it is changing people's lives. You know, here it is making people feel powerful, you know? When you are an entrepreneur, when you're creating your own destiny, when you believe that you are your own boss, you are going to be able to do things that you're passionate about. And I realize that not many people are able to do that. You know, not many people are able to be their own leader. And that's what we really were doing at the time. You know, giving people the opportunity to lead themselves and give them the education to lead themselves. And so we did that for a long time. I was volunteering for the program at the time. And fast forward, you know, 4 years, now I'm working with the program. Now I'm dedicating my life to learning coding I'm dedicating my life for students to learn coding inside prison. And it is incredibly challenging, difficult, inspiring, amazing, all at the same time. It is something that I've never thought I would be doing. I'm not a tech person. I'm not a coder. I'm not an engineer. But I see the value that it has. Technology and coding. Coding, especially, is one of the only things that there's actually a level playing field for.
Right.
You know, if you have a computer, you can learn it. You know, technology is really providing that, it's closing that equity gap.
Yeah, it's a great equalizer.
Be. Exactly.
I mean,
it should be. Yes.
It should, yeah, right? Like,
it should be. Yeah.
It should be in that, like, obviously when we get into, like, tech industry,
yeah, tech
where
culture,
like exactly, that's the right word I was thinking of, like this tech culture where clicks happen, where people gravitate to like what makes them feel comfortable, and like that's when I think you hear the Ellen Powell stories,
mm-hmm.
where you hear this Google memo,
yeah.
that came out, like that's
Uber,
oh my god, like I mean it's just endless in terms of, oh, sexism, colorism,
mm-hmm.
racism, it's microaggressions and
Absolutely.
Aggressions,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, that's where culture really comes in. Sociology can explain this way better than I can, but in an individual sense, and you kind of took the words out of my mouth of why does technology matter?
So with our program, you know, what we're really doing besides, you know, providing technology education is we're providing you an idea even, you know, like there is in prison, there's no technology. There is no computers. You don't have access to the internet. You don't have access to what's actually going around in the world. And you know how technology has transformed our entire world in the last 5 years. Can you imagine being incarcerated for 20 years, you know, and not even coming back outside?
You come out to a different world.
Completely different.
Yeah.
Everyone's on their phones. Everyone's, you know, constantly.
It's very confusing.
Like,
yeah.
Exactly. And here we are just talking about it, you know, just talking about what education is, talking about what smartphones are, what apps are, what technology are, what Uber is, what Facebook is. So yeah, we're talking about how technology has changed the world, what the power of technology is. And it's providing hope inside prison. You know, it's providing a sense of aspiration. You know, they know that they can go online and have access to any type of information that they want.
Mm.
If they want to learn how to be, I don't know, an architect, you can find out online. At least get started. You know, if you want to learn how to code, you can find out online. And here we are. What we do best, I think, is get things that are already online, what are free or donated to our program, and host them in an offline environment. You know, get the proper approvals to do that. Get the proper space to do that. And
how are you allowed to do this?
I spend so much of my time talking to government partners, talking to them about the value of education, about the value of tech education, talking to them about the value of rehabilitative programming in general. You know, and I think that CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitations, they're changing their narrative. You know, they added the R recently, rehabilitation.
Right.
Because
right.
they want to be more rehabilitation focused. For the last 10 years, for the last 20 years, the first 10 years of it, they spent so much time and energy, you know, perpetuating this mass incarceration idea funded by the war on drugs, by, you know, just immigration, all
it
of this stuff.
It was a punitive
Very
system.
Punitive system.
Yeah.
And now they're realizing that doesn't work because
right.
now we've created a system where these individuals are almost even dependent on the incarceration system
right.
because they have no other options. And so here we are saying, here's an option. Here is... the power to potentially, you know, architect your own life, you know?
Just admit you love Ivanka. Just say it. You love her ideas.
I'm not the biggest fan of Ivanka, but that quote, I guess, I'm using.
Yeah, you're
right
just going to run with it. I think what you're providing them, and I know that when I first heard about The Last Mile, it is avoiding the situation that every released inmate has previously incarcerated. What's
formerly
the terminology?
Incarcerated
formerly
individual.
Incarcerated
Better
individual.
Better is individual person with an incarcerated background.
Okay. So when those people re-enter the workforce, that dreaded checkbox
yeah.
of have you committed a felony? Have you been accused? Is it accused of or have you been
convicted?
Right.
Yeah.
That technology and coding basically makes that vanish, where you are able to freelance, you're able to get on websites like even Craigslist or Upwork or whatever and say,
yeah.
hey, I can design a website. Let's not ask each other so many questions.
Absolutely. I mean, people, a lot of development work right now is being outsourced to Philippines, Czechoslovakia, and parts of Russia, and no one's asking for their background checks. The only question they're asking is, can this person code?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and can this person do it efficiently, fast, cheaply, all these things? And here's an untapped human potential that could be potentially doing so many things. You know, the only thing that I think that incarcerated people have that is an advantage to them almost, at least in learning this subject, is time. You know, people always say like, oh, it's so hard. Do I have to go to prison to learn how to code now? You know, this is
that
what...
Is-
people who
Such
are
a joke.
Against
what
me
do you
exactly
mean?
You know, this is what people who
you can
are
learn coding for free.
You could learn how to code for free. The only difference is that you don't have time for it. You know, now here are people who are incarcerated who have time, who should be given every opportunity to learn something hard, challenging, and given the right tools to actually have a ladder towards success.
Do you have people that want to do this
in our program, like joining our program?
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
How many
I mean,
people?
We
what
probably,
are we doing?
Let's say, you know, we're in 5 prisons right now. We have about 125 students. For every class and every cohort, we have 25 spots, and we probably get up to sometimes 50 to 150 applications per cohort.
Wow.
So sometimes I have to turn away, you know, maybe 70% of applicants. But what my hope is, you know, our program is 1 year long. And eventually, hopefully, if you're not in this time, you can get in the next time, you know, because it's only 1 year. But regardless, I think that we're inspiring people inside prison to commit themselves to this hard work. Because it's not easy to learn how to code inside prison. It's not easy to learn how to code without internet access. Learning how to code without internet access is like learning how to swim inside a bathtub.
Hmm.
It's incredibly difficult. And anyone who says that I need to go to prison to learn how to code to get a free coding education has obviously never Googled free coding education.
Yeah, seriously.
Because the only thing that we're doing is really bringing that opportunity inside prison.
What would you tell to a skeptic?
So there's a million things I would tell the skeptic, but one thing that I think really resonates, whether you're Republican or a Democrat, whatever, is regardless of what you believe, 95% of the people currently incarcerated are going to be out at one point in time. They're going to be released back into society.
I never even think about that.
So the question is, who do you want them to be?
Hmm.
Do you want them to be living under a bridge, you know, homeless? Or do you want them to be able to support their family? be able to support their community, to become a taxpaying member and can give back. And what's crazy is I talk to so many individuals inside prison that their number one goal is to just give back. All they want to do is give back because they feel bad for the crimes they've committed against their community because of, you know, their past. And they want to be able to, you know, get a job, contribute to their family, contribute back to society, and potentially be able to do good.
What's interesting is that when people think about, like, prison reform, they think about people that are trying to get rid of the three strikes law, or people that, you know, of course, all of that work is really important.
Yeah.
But, you know, the people, as in, it's a more partisan, you know, conversation mm-hmm. with people that are doing that type of work. People that are, like, you know, trying to reduce the amount of, like, solitary confinement or, you know, lobby or whatever that is.
Yeah.
And they're trying to
make things easier for people incarcerated.
Totally. Getting better conditions or whatever that is. And how you are approaching this problem is unique. That's why I wanted to talk to you. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just, you know, too many people are being incarcerated. We incarcerate more people than the entire world put together. All of those statistics we know. And there are a lot of ways to attack this problem and private prisons and all that kind of stuff. But I think that you're attacking it from an education standpoint, which shouldn't be disputed. It's kind of like this universal thing. Who do you want these people to be when they leave? Let me help.
That increases public safety. You know, if you're scared about, you know, the criminals running rampant in your city, give them an opportunity not to do that again. You know, not to hurt their community. Give them an actual chance to do something, you know, to succeed.
So speaking of recidivism, what are your thoughts in terms of your program?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, right now, so the average rate of recidivism in California is 64%.
Wow.
That means that within 3 years, 64% of those who've gone into prison will go right back into prison.
Who have been released from prison.
Yes, okay. From prison, go back into prison within the next 3 years. That, to me, is not a good success metric.
That doesn't seem successful.
And regardless of even just, like, going back into prison, yeah, that's 64%. But even the, you know, 40 that are, you know, actually, like, not in prison again, do they have a job?
Hmm.
Are they homeless? Are they actually contributing back to society? Or are they, you know, that's not even a really good metric for me to think about success. Success to me is someone who's rehabilitated, you know, contributing back to their family, and actually, you know, giving back to their community. And so the regular statistic in California is 64%. With our program, we have 0% recidivism. None of our graduates have returned to prison. All of them are employed.
Wow.
So we have small numbers. We have maybe 25 released graduates. I mean, they're either employed or continuing education,
mm-hmm.
full-time students. So we have small numbers. We have 29 right now, 29 released graduates.
After a one-year program that they had taken with
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them are contributing back to their society in some way. Some of them are volunteering. Some of them are volunteering for our program. You know, some of them are, you know, volunteering for other programs that work with at-risk youth, incarcerated populations. But you could see that there is a passion inside of them burning, and they contribute their burning passion to what they've learned in our program. And our program isn't easy. You know, our program is extremely difficult.
I know what coding is because I took AP. I was going to. Oh, my God. That's so funny. I did work in tech for 3 years. And I can tell you that many developers. I was at one startup that, you know, I loved the experience. It was awesome. We hired developers who graduated high school but did not go to college.
Mm-hmm.
We hired, we had interns from various nonprofits that came in. Like, we wanted to make sure that we were part of the community that we were in the middle of because of not only the reputation of tech in San Francisco, because we knew we were right in the heart of that, but we wanted to make sure that the community knew how much we cared and that we live in this community.
Yeah.
So we wanted to, you know, contribute to that. But I was gonna say that in high school, I took AP Computer Science for 4 days. quickly.
You quit after 4 days?
I did. I quit after 4 days because I switched over. No, no, no. I'll tell you why. Because I was trying to run Hello World.
Okay.
If anyone knows.
Yes, that's like the like assignment
it's
number
the,
one.
It's the first assignment. It's the first assignment, and the second assignment is to print. No, I want to say printing Hello World is the first assignment,
yes.
Right? I couldn't.
It on an HTML screen.
Correct, correct. And you put it through a terminal.
A text editor.
Whatever. And like, I put it through it, and then I hit run. And I swear I was like following. I swear I was. I followed
yeah.
the directions of the textbook, and it wouldn't run. And I was getting so
it's
fucking
frustrated. Yeah.
And it turned out I tried to get it to run like 5 or 6 times, and it turned out I was missing a semicolon.
That's the way it is.
And
yeah.
I was so irritated that this thing couldn't even run because I didn't put a semicolon
but,
in.
I mean, Hello World. That's like that's
yeah.
Like, 20 characters dude, going through for like what like that's not that like I understand your pain
I,
but
no I
you
okay.
Want to get into our program
yeah yeah I think I would have been rejected for sure but I think it was the process. I have no excuse for trying it 7 times when there were only 20 characters but that it was so frustrating that this whole thing could like break down just because I didn't have a punctuation mark. So like I remember vaguely that frustration from almost 7 years ago, and I switched over to ceramics and made some really
AP ceramics.
AP ceramics. no, like regular ceramics where I made like really shitty bowls, which my mom kept just to tell me that I was a shitty ceramics. Is that
shitty
wait?
Shitty potter.
Potter.
Are you a potter?
I know what a kiln is. Kiln.
Okay.
You know? Good. I know what that is. Yeah, because I failed out of AP Computer Science. So I know.
You understand
what it,
how hard it
I
is.
I understand. I cannot even imagine taking a year of
it's a year and it's
that.
At least 4 days a week, sometimes 5, 8 hours a day learning how to code.
Wait, what?
8 hours a day. It's,
they don't have other schedules?
No, if they're in our program, they're dedicating their time.
Oh,
their
wow.
Program.
Okay, so the whole thing is, like, adjusted to the fact
yeah,
that they've been accepted.
Yeah, consider their job.
Interesting.
They're reassigned.
Got it, got mm-hmm. it. Yeah, because you see Orange is the New Black, and, you know, their education programs are so lacking.
Yeah.
I love how that's, like, my understanding
your
of prison
knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great show.
I love it.
But yeah, no. Is it, do you think it's accurate?
I've watched the first 2 seasons, but
oh,
that's
okay.
Not it.
Yeah.
And
no,
it's,
it gets
like,
pretty inaccurate afterwards.
I started working in a women's prison, and I was like, I don't want to watch this
yeah.
anymore.
Oh my god. So you basically started in a women's prison recently.
Yes. So we're in 2 women's prisons now.
Okay.
But I just started a new women's prison in Chino, where we're from.
How's that experience been?
Away from our hometown.
I know. Natrina and I, even more context, we are from rival high schools.
Yeah.
Hometown. Okay. Yeah.
I did the hand signs for the viewers, for the listeners. They don't know it.
We might take a picture of it afterwards just so that we have
they understand.
It. Yeah, yeah. How serious you are about this. But yeah, you started at a prison,
yeah,
in,
prison
Chino.
In Chino.
That's
and,
awesome.
It's one of the larger women's prisons. We're really excited. But it's so interesting because, you know, here is this women's prison 15 minutes away from where we grew up.
Yeah.
And
I
had no idea.
I would
idea
have,
it was
I
there.
Have no idea.
You know,
I still have
like
no idea. That's crazy.
A large population of people there. And women, especially, are the largest growing demographic inside prison in the last 20 years. They've grown tenfold. And 70% of those women are mothers, which is, you know, you just think about the ripple effect, you know, thinking about the children and, you know, the children of incarcerated parents are 17 times more likely to go back into prison. It's because they didn't have that familiar, like, experience. So it's just the cycle and you see it, you know, you see the way that it's affected people. And for me to be able to go into a women's prison and provide this program, I think it's, I feel really honored, you know, I feel really lucky to be able to provide this education because I know that not everyone gets to follow their dreams and I get to do that.
Lastly, I wanted to touch on our political climate a little bit. because unfortunately your work is quite, I don't want to say dependent, but it is quite reactive to those types of sentiments that are being
out there. Like I said, like I'm not an econ expert. I'm not an immigration expert. I'm not all these things, and I have, you know, opinions about all those subjects. But when it comes to prisons and what I'm seeing with prisons, and I do consider myself an expert in this regard, Jeff Sessions, our attorney general, is doing a lot of things just completely against the prison reform movement that we've created over the last 5-10 years.
It feels very backwards. I just feel like we're moving back in time.
He's reinventing the war on drugs. You know, he's putting back all these mandatory minimums. He's, you know, removing the police task force on age. He hates weed.
Strange.
It just doesn't work. You know, like, regardless of whether or not you think weed is the devil or evil, it's not gonna be fixed by putting more people in prison. And I think that's something that Jeff Sessions needs to understand. I think that's something that voters should understand, that, you know, when you're picking a president, you're not just picking a president, you're picking an entire administration. And what Jeff Sessions represents and what he's done to show what he represents is completely backwards to everything that California prison reformers have been doing for the last 5 years. We've been pushing really hard on reducing mass incarceration because we saw how much money is being spent. It's $60,000 per inmate per year.
Wow.
$60,000. That is more than we spend on higher education, 5 times more than we spend on higher education. Mm. If we redirected those funds to education, just think of how much better our society would be. If we redirected those funds into even rehabilitation, which we're doing, which we're trying to do, I hope that we're going to be able to provide a better society in the future, a more educated, more just society. But with the current administration, with Jeff Sessions, I do feel fear, you know, especially with, you know, in 2014, Obama did a legislation to, you know, end all the contracts with private prisons.
Mm.
And the day that Jeff Sessions was anointed as Attorney General, private prison stocks quadrupled.
Mm.
And that just shows you where we are right now. How could anyone think that capitalizing on criminalization is going to do any good for anyone except for private prisons and private prison lobbyists?
It's just interesting, I think, when prisons have been filled and quadrupled and the stocks for private prisons has
publicly traded,
you
stocks
know,
for
that's
private prisons, yeah.
Where capitalism is banking
mm-hmm.
on people being incarcerated.
Absolutely. They have quotas for people
right?
to
so
keep
then,
incarcerated.
So then why wouldn't it be that there's money riding on more people being filled into prisons? These prisons now having fantastical budgets that can be redirected towards legislative lobbying and passing harsher sentences. Why all of this is linking up? Like, I sound like I'm saying some sort of conspiracy theory, but it's not. It's
yeah.
a very clear line.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Right.
You know? Like,
right.
There's no other reason for anyone to believe that mandatory minimums or private prisons work other than for a bank incentive, other than for monetary incentive. It works in giving private prison investors and lobbyists money, but it doesn't work in rehabilitating. It doesn't work in protecting the community. It doesn't work in, you know, giving anyone a chance or an opportunity to rehabilitate. It just works in the favor of private prisons.
But I do have to say, the targets of these types of legislations is very specific. This is not
yeah.
like anyone that smokes weed.
Mm-hmm.
This is very targeted. Like, you can see now there are CNN articles of like marijuana moms and all these like tweet quotes are like replying to this and being like, great, wish my dad knew about that.
You know, Michelle Alexander wrote a great book called The New Jim Crow, which basically talks about how these slavery laws were kind of embedded into the fabric of our new society today. And I think that it's very evident inside a prison where that you see that those racial distinctions are there. So, yeah, people of color are negatively impacted by these mandatory minimums, this war on drugs, because they're not given the opportunity to do it in a legal way, like marijuana moms would, or people who get licenses. So hopefully we get to the point where, you know, we're actually able to make this an entrepreneurial idea that's affordable and effective for all people. But I think that under the current administration, it's going to be tough.
She's really cool.
She's really dope. When I read her book, The New Jim Crow, it completely changed my perspective on everything. You know, I was like, oh, I'm doing this for, like, oh, this is the right thing to do. You got to give people a second chance. But no, it's so much more than that. It is so much more than a second chance. It's even a first chance. You know, it's even just an opportunity.
It's the first time someone has said, like, hey,
because
let's try this out.
Slavery.
We should end on that.
Yeah.
We should.
It's because of slavery.
Neutrina, thank you so much for joining
Thanks,
me.
Thanks, Sachi. I enjoyed it. This is actually just like a normal conversation between us.
That's true. But if there's anything that we missed, let's catch up next time. I want to thank you for listening. I have so many amazing people to show you, so follow along on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram for updates on new episodes. I'm out.